There's always a moment where you know it's right, you know. A moment in your life where you know that the life you're living is right. And it's a lovely feeling. I think that you have it mostly when you're young. I think when you're young, it happens a lot, you know. You feel good about yourself. For me, it used to happen when I was writing poems. And that's the truth about it, and that's where I began as a writer. I was 15 when I first posted a poem to David Marcus in the Irish Press. I was 15. No, I was 16 when I received a letter of reply. It sat on the dining room table all day while I was at school. I came home on the bus worrying about the Leaving Certificate and Honours Maths classes, which I had recently started. I had completed the Intercert and I was being forced to do Honours Maths against my will. I loved history and English, but maths frightened me. I feared the following 2 years might likely shatter my self-confidence and destroy any sense of worth I was developing. Instead of allowing me to do subjects I loved and write poetry, I was informed that my future was in numbers, which I hadn't any possibility of comprehending. In those days, I studied in an empty dining room at a sombre mahogany table on which the letter had been left by my father, unopened. The table was bought in a swanky store in Dublin, where my father had once worked as a child, packing boxes. While at national school, he was obliged to sell newspapers on the streets every afternoon to help support his impoverished family. He missed the end of each school day, and it so happened that the final lesson in those days was algebra. So like other poor children, he never got beyond adding and subtracting. Being cheated out of what he loved, the magic of numbers, he resolved to make them a part of his adult life. So when he lost his job packing boxes at Pym Brothers on George Street in his early 20s, due to the onset of an economic depression, he decided to change his life and begin night classes. And there began the long ordeal of menial jobs by day and correspondence courses by night, from Rathmines to the University of Glasgow, until he eventually reached the dizzy heights of a profession and became county accountant for Cavan. Married in his 50s, he went back to an old school friend who had packed boxes with him as a child, and he bought a sideboard, four chairs, and a dining room table on which I did my homework. I loved that table. I saw it as a kind of symbol of my father's journey and struggle. And so when my parents were long dead and the old house was being sold, I made sure to take the table with me to Leitrim, where I intended it to function as a temporary addition to our humble abode until we got some furniture of our own. But it lasted the length of my own child's childhood. And I would come home sometimes and smile to find her sitting there in the evenings attendant to whatever absorbed her on the screen of her laptop. The letter that lay unopened in my youth was addressed to me in bold type, which indicated that it must be from an adult. And there was only one adult who might be writing to me with such an officious tone. Using a white business class envelope and affixing the title Esquire to the end of my name. I didn't open it instantly. I needed to get my maths homework out of the way. If I opened the envelope and read a letter of, let's say, rejection, before I opened my maths books, I wouldn't have been able to finish any homework. So I slipped the letter between the pages of Patrick Kavanagh's collected works, which had been published about a year earlier, and which was to me a sacred text during those days. Eventually, before bedtime, I opened and read the letter, written and signed by David Marcus. Well, it was like reading something from Moses, like listening to the verdict of a remote judge. The editor-in-chief of the most important poetry platform in the nation was addressing me. And he liked my poems, and he wanted to publish them. Now, in those days, I used to get the bus to school every morning and home in the afternoons, but I might as well have been a ghost. Neither the Loretta girls in their burgundy skirts nor the demure daughters of the Royal School ever bothered with me. I didn't play football. I didn't have long hair and was never in trouble with the police. So I was a complete non-entity. Getting in trouble with various police forces would have been easy in those days, even if I was only 16. In Enniskillen, where we went regularly as a family to buy butter, there were always RUC men patrolling the street outside Woolworths, fingering their pistols as they glared at young boys like me, and I'm sure the slightest impudence would have brought their ire down upon me as I brushed past them in search of Milky Way bars that were not available in the Free State. Non-entities like me dreamed of such drama. How wonderful it would be to have been in a story where the Loretta girls heard about me being in trouble with the RUC. But it never happened. Although it wasn't the RUC that I feared, it was my mother who policed my adolescence as if I were a medieval prince. She marked out the social boundaries I dared not cross. And being rude with uniformed officers in Enniskillen was the gravest of boundaries, particularly since our car was stuffed with so much butter on the way home. And besides, I was so incompetent at everything that I couldn't even get arrested for not having a light on my bicycle. And I did try regularly, but without success. There was a guard in Cavan at the time who was zealous about the law regarding bicycle lamps. He would wait in the bushes or behind a low wall of suburbia, watching for college students cycling home after official study hours at night, hoping to catch someone who wasn't adequately illuminated. Even my mother thought he was an ignoramus, So it was a notoriety I could have aspired to without fearing her wrath if I had ended up in court. I regularly cycled out in front of the pack, alone and as visible as a black cat in a coal shed. But I was never fortunate enough to do it on a night when the guard was on duty. I would love to have been an heroic narrative. I would have loved to have been caught. It might have secured me more attention on the school bus. But at 16, I had resigned myself to a life of invisibility. Then the poems were published, and my life changed. The Beatles had recorded a few LPs, and Bob Dylan whined and wailed on transistor radio sets beneath the pillows of 1,000 young girls all over the country, and some of them sat by day on my school bus, and up until then, if ever I brushed past their shoulders, they remained as detached as Zen monks. But being a poet trumped even playing football. The heroic poet, solitary and melancholy, languishing in an attic and writing love poems, would have been a matchless prize for any girl in burgundy or green. And sure enough, the moment I stepped onto the dance floor in Cavan after that first publication, I realised I had become a different person. At teenage dances, or hops as we used to call them, I slung my coat over my shoulders like it were a Yeatsian cloak, and for 18 more months I strode along the aisle of the school bus like a great colossus of wounded grace. I never mentioned this aspect of my good fortune to David Marcus when I met him for the first time some years later in his home in Dublin. Even then I was terrified of adults who had achieved so much in life. But I remember him being curious about my life as a writer, and so I mumbled to him something about a book I was working on and how I hoped it would be eventually published. "Oh, it will," he said, with assurance. "Oh, it will." And then he added, "The first of many, I hope." For me, that moment was as life-altering as the first letter, though it was just a casual remark. In that one supportive phrase, my self-image reframed again. He was graciously presuming that I might be on a pathway as a writer for the long term. David Marcus influenced the shape of my life in both those moments. Brief and terse and casual, but yet transformative for me. I felt his presence constantly as a mentor and teacher to whom I remained deeply indebted. There were further letters from Mr. Marcus and further poems by me in the Irish press. There were short stories too, and some years later I received a Hennessy Award, which was another milestone on the way towards life as a full-time writer. It was David Marcus who advised me to use the title Michael P. Harding on my first book, since my father was already known as Michael Harding from his regular book reviews in the same paper. All my opportunities for writing and publishing were direct or indirect consequences of that first letter, and of David Marcus's confidence in my writing and the generosity with which he treated me as a writer, as if he were sure that I had a future. And my father was quietly proud. Even though I may have written an occasional disparaging line about my childhood or my relationship with him, he never flinched in the face of poetry. Whenever he saw me at that old table in the dining room, opening other letters or reading anything other than school books, he would say, "I won't interrupt you, you're at your work." My father died only 6 years after those first poems were published, and the table outlasted him by almost 50 years. Then one leg collapsed, and the tabletop was recycled as a workbench in the garden shed. That happened last year. So in fact, it even outlasted David Marcus by 25 years. There is a way in which I believe that our loved ones are forever with us and in us. So my father's ghost is still a real presence in my life. He shapes my determination to live well. And for an accountant, in his later years, he got enormous pleasure from reading books and composing sentences and writing book reviews. Because David Marcus was the mentor who showed confidence in him too, in that long ago time of my childhood, when I dined on dreams. I wanted to share that with you because for me, David Marcus, somebody I didn't know personally, apart from the letters I would get when he'd be accepting or rejecting some of my poems. And then on one or two occasions, I did meet him in his home in Dublin. But they were always formal. I was in my 20s. I was terrified. And yet, I find it remarkable now, 40 years later, 40 years of being a full-time writer, 40 years since I decided one night, even though I loved what I was doing as a priest in a ministry, in a parish, and yet knowing, I used to say to myself, my life is going on elsewhere. There's something else in my life happening and I'm not aware of it. And I made the decision to step out and to do what I dreamed of. And in that, I have to say, I was helped by the school principal where I was teaching. I was chaplain to a particular school at the time, and I went to the school principal and we took a long walk one evening, and I shared with him that I was thinking of leaving my job as a priest. And I went to him because I think it's a great idea. If you want advice, don't necessarily go to your friend. Don't necessarily go to the person who's going to give you the advice that you think is the right advice yourself. That's only talking to the mirror. When you want advice, sometimes it's really good to go to somebody that you admire, that you respect, but who challenges you, who will confront you with a different viewpoint. And I was absolutely convinced, because at the time I was a young fella, you know, I was a curate, I was a chaplain, I was going around in kind of pink salmon trousers with long hair and a beard. I was a very, very cool chaplain, I can tell you. And the principal was quite a conservative gentleman, and I thought he's the one to go to. So I said to him that I felt, you know, I've been writing for 10 years, I've been doing it in my spare time, but I feel that maybe I should go full time at it and just retire from the ministry, even though I have no problems theologically with the church. I haven't lost my faith, but I feel I should be doing something else, you know. And he said to me, he said, "I've only one piece of advice for you." Because I had said to him, "I'm going to do this next year," right? So we were into the springtime, and I said, "You know, I'll stay another 6 months, but I'm going to plan for it for this time next year." And he said, "Michael, the only advice I'd give you, if you're thinking of going, is don't wait until next year, go immediately." And he said, "Because you'll put it off for 6 months And by that time, you'll put it off for another 6 months and another 12 months, and there'll always be a reason why you put it a little bit further down the road. And then you'll find you're 35 before you realise it, and then you're 40. And you'll keep putting off what you really want to do, and he said eventually, maybe at 40, you'll find you're too old. And that was I can't express how amazing that advice was. Because I did it immediately. You know, I was gone out of the parish, I would say 4 months later. And when I left what was a secure job, if you don't mind, and a nice house going with it and everything, and I ended up like on a bicycle. I had to sell the car I had to survive, and then I was on a bicycle cycling to Dublin. And then I was living in Dublin in very small and cheap accommodation in Oakley Road and Cowper Street in different places. And sometimes I'd go home to Cavan and I wouldn't have the price of a new pair of shoes. And I'd go on the bus because I'd no car. And I'd go in the door at home in Cavan, and the mother used to look at me like I was the broken clock, with a sense of confusion and disappointment in her eyes, wondering, what is this fella who had a good job? A lot of old-fashioned people would see being a curate in those days as, he's a good job, you know? And she never kind of attacked me or criticised me for it, but she'd look at me like, are you mad in the head? What you're doing with your life? Anyway, I look back now, that's 40 years ago, this springtime. And I look back with great, great gratitude. And it's gratitude to loads of people along the way, like my mother, who didn't denounce me for it and always had the door open. She may have been sad and disappointed, but she never made a row about it. And when I went to get married, she was open and wonderful and joyful about it, and we danced all night at the wedding. But that teacher was a crucial person. And if I go back to the very earliest person that influenced me, it was that man, David Marcus, editor of the Irish Press at the time. Didn't know him, wasn't personal. I was a 15-year-old kid. He was a major player in the Irish literary circles. And yet his advice to me, his encouragement, his faith, his confidence in me, which came out of him like normally, and yet it led to a sense of confidence as I sit writing poetry, that every single thing in my life came out of that. And it just amazes me now how that sense of confidence that you can give to a young person can be so important to them. And you know, they say mull an oige agus chohishiad. And in the present day, there's loads of stuff that you'd get uneasy with young people because they want to change the structures of society, and they want to change the idea of identity, and they want to change so much concepts of institutions and all the rest of it. My instinct is to praise, to encourage. They will work it out. They will work it out in ways that wouldn't be clear to me. I can't understand maybe where we're going because I'm 70. And so what the 70-year-old needs to do, or the 60-year-old, or any parent, is to encourage a young person. And encouraging them is not sort of giving a license, like do what you want. Because that's not really encouragement, that's not really confidence building, that's actually just saying, well, I don't care what the feck you do. Confidence is actually focused on something in particular. If you have somebody who's a footballer, somebody who's on the camogie team, somebody who's doing horse jumping or something, confidence is saying, I know you can get over that fence. I believe in you, and I'm going to be standing here looking, watching. That's confidence. And so confidence in young people is saying that I really believe that you can find new ways to show compassion and love and joy. And even if religion is in transition, and you might think that would matter to me because I'm so enthusiastic about faith, I'm so enthusiastic about religion. I saw on St. Patrick's Day last week, and I just saw the photograph. It was a photograph of a parade. And sometimes they have St. Patrick, nearly always in a parade, they have St. Patrick with the bishop's mitre and a green sort of priest's vestments, if you like, and a big mitre like a bishop. And that's a very, very common image. But there was one parade last week, and it went further in the detail. And I saw a photograph of it. It was on the back of a lorry, and they actually had an altar. They actually had an altar with lace, with a lit candle, with a chalice, and St. Patrick behind it. All you could say was that he was saying Mass. Now, there would be people of my age who would consider that blasphemous, who would be horrified by it. And I'd say if it happened 20 years ago, that it would be on the Joe Duffy show for a month with people giving off. It's a mark of the times that nobody would be bothered with that. Now, nobody would think it was offensive. And then you might think, well, isn't that a pity? But I don't think so. I really don't. And it's not that I disrespect the Eucharist or that it doesn't matter an enormous amount to me. But I also feel that the more there is a kind of a tolerance for every idea and every criticism and every argument, and if people want to criticize different religions, young people particularly, that they almost should be encouraged to do so. Because when I would encourage a young person to criticize and to question the religion, I'm actually saying to them that it matters to me that you find out what your faith is. I want you to find out your faith, your own faith. So if that means that you have to really take a bit of a swipe at the church or at patriarchy, smash the patriarchy, whatever you need to do to find your truth, do it and do it now. Because that's the advice that I got. And I couldn't have predicted what would have happened in my life on the day that I was encouraged by that teacher to go and follow your dream. And maybe a wiser man would have said about me, he doesn't have the talent to be a full-time writer. Don't be encouraging him. He'll go astray. Hasn't he a good job? Isn't he good at what he does? Tell him to stick at what he's at. But no. He identified that in me it was a dream. In me it was a single faith and belief. And I couldn't name it. And you can't name your life until you live it. You can't name your dream until you live it. But he was sharp enough to see that and to say, follow your dream. Follow your heart. Again, I don't think it means in a wishy-washy way to follow every emotion. Like that you might have a fad for show jumping this year. So you encourage a person to go in that direction, and then next year you find they've a fad for something completely different. And you encourage them in that direction. I think that one of the measures that a dream in a young person's heart is really strong is that there is consistency. And I don't think it's difficult to set up a process whereby you test that consistency. Very often with young writers, if they came to me, the test is really to go and write something. You know, so that you have somebody who comes to you and they are looking for advice or encouragement, and they say that they're writing a book or a play. And I would say to them, well, go and write it and come back to me and show it to me. Because that's putting the challenge on them to go away and spend 6 months working at it. So consistency would be something that I suppose the teacher, in my case, when I was thinking of going to be a full-time writer, the teacher who I went to for advice, he would have known that I had already spent 15 years following my dream. I was like at 30 years of age. If I began writing poetry when I was 15, that's 15 years. I had my own typewriter at hand always, and I used to spend very often evenings after school, 2 or 3 hours. I loved nothing more than the hours between, let's say, 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock, when I would devote to writing. On any day, and I used to love it. So there was a consistency that he was praising when he'd tell me to follow my dream. But it did change my life. And I feel very excited whenever I'm talking to a young person and I feel that in some sense they're listening to me. Now, when young people don't listen to you, it's not a bad thing. In a sense, they shouldn't be listening to you. They need to listen to their own heart, and they need to get on with their life, and they need to change the world. That's the way it happens. That's the way it happens. It is for young people to change the world. And at 70, you must never be kind of worried and depressed and feeling, oh, they're changing the world. They're supposed to. They're supposed to. If I look back to when I was a young fella in the 60s, and if I look at the way the world was then and imagine if it didn't change, well, it would be terrible. You know, that's one of, it's a real strange thing now, but I can never resist slipping into a sense of awe about God's presence. Because the way the world unfolds, to me, seems to be always a revelation of God's presence. It's so mysterious. God's presence is like, I talk about it in nature, you know. Christ before me, Christ behind me. It doesn't mean that there's a Victorian ghost behind me or before me or above me. There isn't a figure, you know, with long hair, looking like a Middle Eastern male floating around the place. That's not what I get when I think Christ before me, Christ behind me. And in fact, I noticed when I was reading Evagrius a couple of years ago, how he said that if the monk, and we're talking 3rd, 4th century in the deserts of Egypt, but he would say that if the monk is meditating on the presence of Christ, a visual image is not such a great idea. In fact, if you do have a visual image of Christ, it can be very unhelpful. I suppose what he meant was that it creates a category. It creates an idea of Christ as, you know, an object in the universe. And that actually takes away the intimacy between you and Christ. So I'll tell you where you get real intimacy with Christ. Let me tell you. And it's all hidden in that amazing poem. Christ before me, Christ behind me, Christ above me, Christ within me, Christ in everyone I meet. You know, that ancient 6th century poem, prayer by St. Patrick, or attributed to him, is not a Victorian idea like there's a ghost called Christ floating around behind me or before me. What it means is that if I'm standing here, as I am at the minute, and I'm looking out the window at the gorse, wild, big, Oh, huge big patches of it now, rising to heaven, dark green and blazing yellow. That's what I'm looking at. When I say Christ before me, I'm looking at the gorse and I'm thinking of the gorse, and it's the gorse that I mean when I say Christ before me. And if there is a lake behind me, which there's not, okay, there's the wall of the studio behind me. That's what's behind me. There's a wall, there's two bookcases with books in them. That's what's behind me. So when I say Christ behind me, I'm not sort of imagining some kind of ghostly figure. What I am meaning is that the bookcases and the wall and the molecules and the atoms that make them substantial in time and space, they vibrate with the presence of Christ. That is Christ. That is my Christ. Everything around me is Christ. Normally now I say God. I say everything around me is God. Normally I quote the Islamic idea, there is nothing but God. There is nothing. There is nothing. Nothing exists but is God. I see everything around me, all reality around me, as a veil that is both hiding and revealing God's presence. And today I'm just switching that slightly because I'm focusing on Christ. And what I'm saying is that I don't buy into that Christ as being some sort of Victorian ghost, some sort of, you know, replication of the image that we have at the resurrection, that there's this figure floating around the place. Because when you do that, the same as when you do it with God, you have created a category, you've created an object in the universe. You've created a being as an object. So Christ then becomes the being that may be the most supreme being in the universe, bigger than any elephant or mouse that was ever created, or dinosaur, but essentially, maybe not physical, maybe metaphysical, but you're still talking about a being that has been created, that's there objectively in the universe. And that's not what they say, you know, about Christ. What the theologians have been saying for hundreds of years is that there is nothing but God. That in the reality we are experiencing, in the trees and the flowers, in the gorse, in the books, in the walls, in all the molecules, in all the luminosity and light that comes out of everything, we are experiencing Christ. Being itself is God. And in Christ, it becomes focused within the narrative of history. So he becomes the lens, like an icon I talk about as the lens. So the icon is reading you. But the icon is not in itself some object of magic or object to be revered. It's simply that the wood in the icon and the image in the icon function as a lens so that you can experience not just the shape of the wood, not just the tree outside the window, not just the gorse, but you can actually experience the deep reality of that gorse, whins, bush, that cherry tree, that you can experience the deepest reality of it as one with your own reality, as mystical, as loving as Christ. Christ before me, Christ behind me. And it's a powerful poem or prayer to recite, especially coming up to the Easter week. And you ask yourself, as you say it. Am I thinking here of some sort of Victorian, pale, ghostly, floating around figure called Christ? Or am I experiencing everything sensately, everything that my senses absorb as in themselves the manifestation and presence of Christ? And if it is the latter, then you're with St. Paul. You know, you're with St. Paul's sense of the Christ, Jesus, who became the Christ, who is the transformative cosmic light in the universe and is everywhere and is in everyone and calls everyone to be and calls them to be alive in the deepest truth of their being. Which is funny, because that brings me back to the writing. And it brings me back to what I was saying at the very start of the chat, the very start of this podcast. You know, I was saying that in some sense to reach for your own truth is to create your own happiness, to reach for what your heart consistently wants, and to do that truth is the pathway to enlightenment or happiness or heaven or whatever you want to call it. To be fully yourself. To listen. And not just to listen to the consistent voice inside you, but to listen also for teachers. And that's an amazing way that I think when I talk about, let's say, Christ being present in everything, that there is nothing but Christ, if you like. I see his blood upon the rose, in the stars, the glory of his eyes. There's nothing but Christ. It is all Christ. When you look at it like that, when you see it like that, you also begin to see very modern things as Christ. The typewriter, the computer, the way that history moves forward, sometimes through darkness, sometimes through appalling conflicts, wars, famines, Auschwitz. Sometimes the darkest of things happen, and yet in a strange way we know from history, all will be well. The darkness never prevails. Like, it may for decades. And there are times when you look at life in somewhere like the Soviet Union and you might despair. Certainly in Nazi Germany, but in the Soviet Union, the darkness was more slow and gradual. People's hearts kind of rotted with despair. Except that there were enough to keep it alive, to the hope of truth, of doing your truth, believing in your truth, following your heart. So everything is a revelation. It's not just nature. When you say there's nothing but God, it's not just nature. It's the car you're driving. It's the telephone you're using. It's the smartphone you're texting on. Everything. It's the computer you're using. There's no moment, I believe, in my life, there is no moment in which I am not being directed. There's no moment where I am not getting guidance from a wise teacher. And the wise teacher might be some person who walks in the door and gives me advice or says something casual to me in a supermarket. It might be the way the cat relates to me emotionally. Whatever is happening, whatever arises in the interaction between my consciousness and the sensate reality around me, whatever that junction is, in each moment I'm being directed. And if I listen to my heart, in each moment I will find the direction. I will just know. It's called awakening to your conscience. And this is one of the best advices you could give to young people too. Rather than chastising them when you're kind of worried that, God, maybe they'll be on the wrong direction, you know. In the old days, people would joke, you know, you'd see the young one going out the door, 16 years of age, and she's going out for, you know, one of her first disco experiences with a skirt wrapped around her thighs and high heel boots. And you'd say, where are you going in that? She'd say, oh, I'm going out. And you want to say things like, you're not leaving the house like that. Maybe there is a reason to say that. Maybe there is a time to be more, in a loving way to put sort of some sort of context on how young people should live their lives. Maybe there is a reason for that. Maybe we don't do enough of it as parents. You know, we don't give enough context and say, look, there is the context in which you can go out now. But you put limitations on the young person because they may not, too much freedom too soon can be a burden, can make young people angry and frustrated. There's a possibility that too much liberal behaviour in the past 20, 30 years in Western culture is actually what's making young people unhappy and angry. Because surveys are showing that young people are more unhappy than they were 30 or 40 years ago, which is worth thinking about. And there's no doubt that young people, and by that I mean people up to their 30s, they're very angry. I'm not saying that they have a right. They have a right to be angry. I'm not saying what's right or wrong in relation to how we look after young people. I think that what I'm saying is that young people, when they're young teenagers, they might be happier if they're given a context within which to be happy. You say, like, these are the limits to your freedom for the moment. When you're 18, you can get more freedom. That may be the case. And I don't think that contradicts my other view, which sounds the opposite. That the best thing you can do for young people is to encourage them to believe in their dreams. So the two seem like a little bit of a paradox, and maybe that is also part of the mystery of how you try and cope with the world as it changes. But I'm certain that in my life, I think in anybody's life, there is never a single moment where you're not getting direction. If you listen in the moment. And this goes for me, I can tell you, even if I'm confused about something so badly that I wake in the middle of the night worrying about it, and that's always a really interesting thing. What keeps you awake at night? What keeps you awake at night? Ask yourself that. And rather than ignore it, get up out of the bed and listen to it. But don't like go with it. Just listen to it, you know. So I wake in the middle of the night and I'm angry with somebody who I have to have a meeting with, let's say, about the theatre, and it's going to happen in the next 10 days. And just do something about this other person irritates me, and I wake in the middle of the night irritated, and I feel I know the cause of the irritation. And I do sit with it. I do think about it. But I never act on it. I listen. I hear my little heart inside whinging. And I do say, I hear you. And in that kind of silence, I find I'm getting direction. In that kind of silence, it's like I'm getting advice from God. Now, I won't say I'm getting advice from God, because that sounds absolutely too outrageously crazy on my part to be so hubristic to think that the ground of all being is chatting personally to me. I think that's why we talk about angels. Angels are supposed to be messengers of God. Angels are a sort of a luminosity within everything, a presence that's never far away from us. So a better way to put it probably is that in those moments in the middle of the night when I'm kind of, you know, irritated about an editor in a publishing house or somebody I have to meet in relation to theatre, and I simply observe what's inside me. I observe the whinging little heart, the hurt and the wounded little heart. And I listen, and I say to my little heart, I'm listening to you. And that's all I have to do. And in some strange way, the entire cosmos enfolds me. It just feels like I'm comfortable. It's 4 o'clock in the morning, and yet 10 minutes ago I was angry. I woke up. Now I paid it attention. I'm not angry anymore. I don't have to get up in the morning and phone the guy and give off to him. I don't have to do anything. But simply by listening, I could feel I was getting direction. And that brings me back to the present moment. So, the present moment is eternal, and the journey of life is to enter into that moment fully. And death will not be a darkness, death will be a moment of opportunity when you completely let go and release yourself from your ego, and you fall into complete enlightened peace in heaven. And that's what I hope for. And between now and then, I feel we can always get this moment, this heavenly moment. We can get this ecstasy now in the Eucharist, in the sacraments, in silent and solitary prayer, in love, in intimacy. And if we believe that, then that's what we'll have in our hearts when we talk to young people. And then we will, rather than be telling them they're going the wrong direction or they shouldn't be doing this or they shouldn't be doing that, we're more likely to say, I believe in you. You will find your goal. Because what you're saying really is that you believe God will find them. If I believe in God, I'm not worried about young people, because it's he that believes in them. And all will be well. And they too will find themselves at moments in their life, in the present moment, awakened. Awakened in the present moment, they too, in their turn, will have these moments of enlightenment and insight and wisdom. And they too will realize from the direction they get in the heart that all things will end in peace. All will be well. Thank you for being here. Bye-bye.